خيام إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر. تسكله ماسا لون وطن، تسكله ماسا لون وطن، نفقا لعودة اللاجئين وفراش المنفى من شتات وتغريب.
Welcome to the June 30th edition of This Week in Palestine on WZBC Newton 90.3 FM, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States commercial media. On today's show, we feature the concluding keynote speech of Professor Joseph Massad at the Right of Return Conference held at Boston University on April 6th to 7th of this year, 2013. Joseph Massad teaches modern Arab politics and intellectual history at Columbia University. Professor Massad has written extensively on the Palestine question in academic journals and books. In this keynote speech, he provides the historical background for the Palestine right of return. But first, let's listen to the weekly news update courtesy of the International Middle East Media Center. Stay tuned for a thought-provoking segment of This Week in Palestine.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for June 22nd to the 28th, 2013. As U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in the region this week to revive the peace process, Israel continued settlement construction and troops escalated attacks targeting Palestinians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank. This week, protests were organized in the villages of Annabi Saleh, Bil'in and Na'lin in central West Bank, in addition to Al-Ma'sara in southern West Bank. Israeli soldiers used tear gas, chemical water and rubber-coated steel bullets to attack the weekly protests at the villages of Bil'in, Na'lin and the nearby Annabi Saleh. At the villages of Bil'in and Na'lin, residents and their international and Israeli supporters managed to reach the wall. Meanwhile, at the village of Annabi Saleh, Israeli soldiers attacked the villagers and their supporters before leaving the village. In addition, Israeli troops stormed the village and fired gas bombs into residents' homes. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation at all three villages. Elsewhere, at Al-Ma'sara village, Israeli troops stopped the villagers and their supporters at the village entrance, then forced them back using rifle butts and batons to push people back. No injuries were reported. This week, top Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat announced that the release of Palestinian political prisoners from Israel and Israel recognition of the 1967 borders as boundaries of future Palestinian state were agreed on during the Oslo Peace Accords of 1993. I am EMC's Ram El Mighari with more details.
Bringing new ideas for peace, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in the region this week in order to push both Palestinians and Israelis for peace. Kerry will try to convince both sides of returning back to negotiations table. Some sources suggest that in the shadow of Israel's failure to halt settlement activities on occupied Palestinian territories, Kerry will be urging Israel to release a number of old Palestinian prisoners detained prior to the Oslo Accords of 1993. The release of those prisoners will likely be completed within stages so that Israel will guarantee return of Palestinians to the negotiations table. The Palestinian Authority still considers Israeli settlements building on occupied Palestinian lands as the obstacle towards peace talks and that Israel should immediately stop them. Peace talks have been stalled for more than 2 years now, with Israel accelerating settlements construction, something that would preempt any final status solution based on the 1967 borders. In Jerusalem, Israeli President Shimon Peres and his Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu believed this week that a binational state on the lands of Palestine is an unworkable or viable solution. They announced acceptance of a two-state solution that would guarantee the security of the state of Israel. In another news, both the Islamic Hamas movement in Gaza and the Fatah Party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are yet to agree on national conciliation. Prime Minister of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is expected to visit Gaza by early July to push for conciliation between the two sides. For IMEMC News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli army conducted at least 48 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank and Gaza. During these attacks, Israeli troops kidnapped at least 25 Palestinians, including 5 children. IMEMC's Salam Kumsiya has more.
This week, invasions and kidnappings by the Israeli army were focused in the West Bank cities of Ramallah, Jenin, Tubas, and Hebron. On Monday, Israeli fighter jets fired several missiles targeting what the army called weapons storage facilities in the Gaza Strip, and another location apparently used as a training center for assistance group. Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad, reported that Israeli war jets bombarded two of its centers west of Khan Yunis and Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Several missiles were also fired into an agricultural land near Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Furthermore, an Israeli warjet fired missiles into a center that belongs to the Palestinian National Security Forces in Gaza. Damages were reported, but no injuries. In the West Bank, also on Monday, a group of settlers from Havad Gilad settlement raided Palestinian civilians' land in Amatin village, northeast of Qalqilia, and cut off 6 olive trees. Furthermore, a group of settlers from Carmel settlement, also near Qalqilia, attacked a group of farmers and shepherds. The attacks took place in the presence of Israeli army forces that declared the area as a closed military zone and arrested 2 Palestinian civilians after claiming they assaulted settlers. On Wednesday, a group of settlers from Ovijal settlement near Hebron attacked Palestinian shepherds with police dogs while they were grassing their sheep in Al-Ataria area. Moreover, Israeli settlers raided pastoral lands in the surroundings of Khirbet Kwewis, also near Hebron, and told shepherds of Abu Arim family to leave the area, claiming that it is their property. Israeli troops arrived at the scene and ordered the shepherds to leave the area. Later in the week, a number of extremist Israeli settlers burned, Thursday, Palestinian agricultural lands planted with olive and almond trees owned by farmers of Sebastia village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. For IMEMC News, this is Salam Kumsiya.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for June 22nd to the 28th, 2013, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
So I'm extremely excited to announce the next, our final keynote speaker and our final presentation of the Right of Return Conference. We will be hearing from the esteemed doctor, Joseph Massad. Joseph Massad currently teaches modern Arab politics and intellectual history at Columbia University. Massad has written extensively on the issue of Palestinian identity and self-determination, and he is one of the foremost Palestinian academics in the United States today. A student of the late Palestinian intellectual Edward Said, he is the author of Colonial Effects, The Making of National Identity in Jordan, and The Persistence of the Palestinian Question, Essays on Zionism and Palestinian Nationalism. In addition to his tremendous works on identity and self-determination, he is renowned for his thought-provoking studies on the histories of desire, gender, and sexuality in the Arab world, and his latest book, Desiring Arabs, received the Lionel Trilling Book Award in 2008. He also writes columns on Palestinian and Arab affairs for Al Jazeera English's website, Al-Ahram Weekly, and the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar. His forthcoming book is titled Islam and Liberalism. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Joseph Massad.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Alex, and thank you for inviting me to this wonderful conference. I'm delighted to be here, of course, and thanks to all of you who've stayed after this long day or 2 days. I understand it's been quite tiring, so I will try not to be terribly boring, although, of course, all the important things have already been said. I have very few things to add, perhaps more repetition, and trying to give some conclusive maybe overview of the situation that we face. All right. The title of my talk is Returning Rights. Since its inception, the Zionist project was clear in its goals and the strategy required to achieve them. In order for Jews to colonize the lands of the Palestinians and establish an exclusivist Jewish state, the Zionist strategists insisted the natives must be driven out of the country. For Zionism, colonization and expulsion were to be simultaneous processes that could not be decoupled from one another. Indeed, they would become the very same process. At the same time, Zionism insisted, following millenarian Protestant restorationist claims, that European Jews, rather than being descendants of European converts to Judaism, were actually descendants of the ancient Hebrews who had been allegedly exiled by the Romans in the first century AD. Based on this double fiction, Zionism claimed that European Jews were in fact returning to Palestine in order to colonize it. Indeed, that European Jews had the right to return to their original homeland. Thus, Jewish colonization was one and the same as Jewish return to Palestine, just as it was one and the same as a Jewish expulsion of the Palestinians from the country. Once Zionism had political control of Palestine, it followed two policies to ensure that its colonial project continued unhindered. On the one hand, it insisted that the Palestinians it expelled had no right to return to Palestine, and that it would prevent their attempt to return by military means while expelling as many as possible of those who remained. On the other hand, it decreed in 1950 a law of return for Jews, endowing them with the right to colonize Palestine, which is presented as a right, or as their right, to recolonize it. Turning the rights of the Palestinians to their homes and homeland into the rights of European Jews to return to Palestine was and continues to be the main political, legal, and ideological strategy of Zionism and the principal policy of the State of Israel. This translates into the only political formula that Zionist and Israeli leaders, as well as the Palestinian people, agree on, namely, that Jewish colonization means expulsion of the Palestinians, and Palestinian return means Jewish decolonization. What the two sides disagree on is which part of the formula they want to enforce. Understanding the transfer of the rights of one people to another, Edward Said affirmed, and I quote him, that the colonization of Palestine proceeded always as a fact of repetition. The Jews were not supplanting, destroying, breaking up a native society. That society was itself the oddity that had broken the pattern of a 60-year Jewish sovereignty over Palestine, which had lapsed for two millennia. Zionism therefore reclaimed, redeemed, repeated, replanted, realized Palestine and Jewish hegemony over it. Israel was a return to a previous state of affairs, even if the new facts bore a far greater resemblance to the methods and successes of 19th century European colonialism than to some mysterious first century forebears. Unquote. The propagation of the Zionist movement of the Protestant restorationist slogan that Palestine was a country without people for a people without a country betrayed not only the wishful thinking of Zionism, but also its understanding that its planned expulsion of the Palestinians would not garner international support. Thus, the propagated slogan was really a conscious cover-up for the Zionist belief that Palestine was a country with an undeserving people for a deserving people without a country. The representation of the Palestinians as a parasitic people who have done nothing to improve Palestine over the centuries and who allegedly left the land fallow without cultivation drives Theodor Herzl to exclaim in his novel Altneuland, and I quote him, "If only we had the people here to restore the land," unquote. It bears noting that Zionists borrowed the notion of a parasitic people from anti-Semitic representations of European Jews and from the corresponding racist colonial representation of the natives of the Americas, of Australia and Africa. Many Zionist plans were devised over the decades to bring about the expulsion of the Palestinians, starting with the simple plan advanced by Herzl, which proposed expelling Palestinian peasants off their land after the Zionists purchased it from absentee landlords for Jewish colonization. Dispossessing Palestinian peasants of their lands, however, would not be sufficient. Herzl understood that Palestinians as a whole must be dispossessed of their homeland altogether in order for Zionism to establish a Jewish settler colony. In his 1896 pamphlet, Der Judenstaat, The State of the Jews, Herzl explained, and I quote him, "An infiltration of Jews is bound to end badly. It continues till the inevitable moment when the native population feels itself threatened and forces the government to stop further influx of Jews. Immigration is consequently futile unless we have the sovereign right to continue such immigration." Unquote. To achieve a takeover of the land, Herzl proposed in his diaries that the Jewish colonists would gently expropriate the natives' property and, quote, and this is a famous quote, perhaps many of you know it, try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit countries while denying it any employment in our own country. The property owners will come over to our side. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly. Let the owners of immovable property believe that they are cheating us, selling us things for more than they are worth, but we are not going to sell them anything back." Unquote. Herzl's understanding would percolate through the Zionist movement and would be adopted by his Zionist followers, who would suppress all future dissent on this matter. Speaking of Palestinian resistance in 1923 and arguing against those who were proposing a compromise with the natives, Vladimir Jabotinsky, the founder of revisionist Zionism, the rival of mainstream Zionism, understood well how colonization and expulsion were one and the same thing. He wrote, and I quote, "Any native people, it's all the same whether they are civilized or savage, views their country as their national home, of which they will always be the complete masters. They will not voluntarily allow not only a new master, but even a new partner. And so it is for the Arabs. Compromisers in our midst attempt to convince us that Arabs are some kinds of fools who can be tricked and who will abandon their birthright to Palestine for cultural and economic gains. Note, birthright is a very important word today, especially after Susan Akram's important remarks. Jabotinsky continues, I flatly reject this assessment of the Palestinian Arabs. Culturally, they are 500 years behind us. Spiritually, they do not have our endurance or our strength of will. But this exhausts all the internal differences. They look upon Palestine with the same instinctive love and true fervor that any Aztec looked upon his Mexico or any Sioux looked upon the prairie. This childish fantasy of our Arabophiles comes from some kind of contempt for the Arab people, that this race is a rabble ready to be bribed or sell out their homeland for a railroad network, unquote. Jabotinsky understood well that the Palestinians, as he put it, are not a rabble, but a nation. Unlike Herzl, who thought the expulsion process would be carried out gently through dissimulation, Jabotinsky's strategy was to expel the Palestinians from their homeland using military force. He added that, quote, Zionist colonization must either be terminated or carried out against the wishes of the native population, unquote, concluding, in his words, that Zionism is a colonization adventure, and therefore it stands or falls by the question of armed force, unquote. Brushing aside any ethical concerns, he concluded in 1939, at the conclusion of the Palestinian revolt, that, quote, there is no choice. The Arabs must make room for the Jews of Eretz Israel. If it was possible to transfer the Baltic peoples, which was ongoing between Stalin and Hitler in 1939, he continues, it is also possible to move the Palestinian Arabs, unquote. The debates that the Zionists would have in the 1920s and 1930s about what they termed the transfer of the Palestinians, remember at the time they also were engaged in transferring German Jews to Palestine through a surreptitious transfer agreement that they signed with Hitler. The debates that they had in the 1920s and 30s about what they termed the transfer of the Palestinians are rich in detail, but their conclusion was inescapable. Concurring with Jabotinsky, David Ben-Gurion, the leader of the colonial settlers of mainstream Zionism, declared in June 1938, and I quote, I support compulsory transfer. I do not see anything immoral in it, unquote. His statement would follow the policy adopted by the Jewish Agency, which was the main Zionist organ in charge of advancing Jewish colonization of Palestine, which set up its first, quote, population transfer committee, as it called it, in November 1937 to strategize the forceful expulsion of the Palestinians. A key member of the committee was Joseph Weitz, the director of the Jewish Agency's colonization department, aptly titled, of course. This was hardly coincidental. As colonization and expulsion are part of the same policy, Weitz's view and the role and his role were central to both. Weitz articulated the matter famously. I quote him, between ourselves, it must be clear that there is no room for both peoples together in this country. We shall not achieve our goal if the Arabs are in this small country. There is no other way than to transfer the Arabs from here to neighboring countries. All of them. Not one village, not one tribe should be left, unquote. The Jewish Agency would set up a second population transfer committee in 1941 and a third one during the Zionist conquest of Palestine in May 1948. All this planning would come to fruition in the form of ethnic cleansing or the ethnic cleansing operation encapsulated in the Israeli army's Plan Dalit, which was adopted in March 1948 by the Haganah. Plan Dalit's precepts, however, were enshrined in earlier versions of the same plan and were put into practice 4 months earlier, beginning on November 30, 1947, the day after the United Nations voted to partition Palestine and when the expulsion of the Palestinians by Zionist military force started. If Jewish colonization of the country was inaugurated in the 1880s by evicting Palestinians from their land through legal and financial means, And this is something that's very important. People forget that Palestinian peasants were expelled off their lands beginning in the 1880s. It's the military expulsion that begins in 1948. But for 50 years prior to that, you already had this financial, legally binding expulsion, which could not be questioned at the time in a court of law. If Jewish colonization of the country was inaugurated in the 1880s by evicting Palestinians from their land through legal and financial means, Zionism's failure to acquire more Palestinian lands made it clear that only a forceful illegal eviction would achieve this goal. In 65 years of aggressive purchases and legal and illegal acquisition of Palestinian land between 1882 and 1948, under the protection of the British occupation, the Zionists were able to acquire less than 7% of the lands of Palestine and could only expel tens of thousands of Palestinian peasants living on that portion of the land. If this was the rate at which land purchases were to continue, the best-case scenario meant that the Zionists would need another 9 centuries to buy the rest of the country and expel the rest of the Palestinians. That the Palestinians raised a massively successful national campaign against selling lands to Zionists rendered even that scenario a very optimistic one. This surely was not an acceptable solution for the Zionists, and one that they had anticipated and expected, as you could tell from Herzl's comments, and which necessitated forceful ethnic cleansing as the most effective way to successful colonization. By May 14, 1948, about 400,000 Palestinians had already been ethnically cleansed by advancing Zionist forces, who were not only securing the borders of the Jewish settler colony that the partition plan granted them, but were already well into the territory of the projected Palestinian state. It was this expulsion and territorial encroachment that became the casus belli, the reasons for war, for the weak and ill-equipped neighboring Arab armies to intervene, to put a stop to the ongoing expulsion and colonization. The weaknesses of the Arab armies, or the weakness of the Arab armies, was well known to the Americans and the Zionists. U.S. Secretary of State George Marshall's assessment was as follows. Let me read it to you. The whole government structure of Iraq is endangered by political and economic disorders of the Iraqi government, and it cannot at this moment afford to send more than a handful of troops, but more than the handful of troops it has already dispatched. Egypt has suffered recently from strikes and disorders. Its army has insufficient equipment because of the refusal of the British to aid it. And what it has is needed for police duty at home. Syria has neither arms nor an army worthy of the name and has not been able to organize one since the French left 3 years ago. Lebanon has no real army, while Saudi Arabia has a small army which is barely sufficient to keep the tribes in order. Jealousies between Saudi Arabia and the Syrians on the one hand and the Hashemite governments of Jordan and Iraq on the other prevent Arabs from making even the best of the existing forces, unquote. American officials understood this very well. Indeed, Robert McClintock, a member of the U.S. delegation to the UN, observed on May 4th, 11 days before the Arab armies intervened, that the Security Council would soon be confronted with the question as to, quote, whether Jewish armed attack on Arab communities in Palestine is legitimate, or whether it constitutes such a threat to international peace and security as to call for coercive measures by the Security Council. My good colleague who is now here, Irene Genzier, is writing a book actually on this period. McClintock further observed that if Arab armies entered Palestine, this would lead the Jewish forces to claim, and I quote, that their state is the object of armed aggression and will use every means to obscure the fact that it is their own armed aggression against the Arabs inside Palestine which is the cause of the Arab counterattack, unquote. This is an American official who understood the situation, as did the American government in 1948. Given their weakness and the strength of the invading Zionist army, the Arab armies failed to stop the ongoing expulsion of the Palestinians and the colonial expansion of Israel. Ben-Gurion did not dissimulate when he described the situation on the ground. I quote him, "Let us not ignore the truth among ourselves. Politically, we are the aggressors and they defend themselves. The country is theirs because they inhabit it, whereas we want to come here and settle down. And in their view, we want to take away from them their country. He would add, and I quote, and this is a famous quote, "If I was an Arab leader, I would never make terms with Israel. That is natural. We have taken their country. Sure, God promised it to us. But what does that matter to them? Our God is not theirs. We come from Israel. It's true. But that was 2,000 years ago. And what is that to them? There has been anti-Semitism, the Nazis, Hitler, Auschwitz. But was that their fault? They only see one thing. We have come and stolen their country. Why should they accept that?" Unquote. Understanding the Palestinian position, however, did not deter Ben-Gurion from assessing the success of Zionist policies, namely that successful Jewish colonization can only be achieved through successful expulsion of the Palestinians. A reversal of the expulsion would undo this coupling and indeed reverse colonization. This is why Ben-Gurion and all subsequent Israeli governments categorically refused to allow the Palestinian refugees to return home. While the expulsion was ongoing in July 1948, Ben-Gurion insisted that, quote, "we must do everything to ensure that the Palestinians never return," unquote. Indeed, the leadership of the Jewish settler colony hoped that the old Palestinians will die and the young will forget. But this was not to be. The Palestinians have neither died away nor forgotten their rights, and those among them who remain on the land continue to be steadfast in the face of Israel's colonial expulsion policies. Thousands of Palestinians, contrary to Ben-Gurion's expectations, attempted to return between 1948 and 1956 under the cover of darkness by crossing Israel's makeshift colonial borders, but Israeli guns awaited them. The Israeli army would kill upwards of 5,000 of them during this period, calling them foreign infiltrators. Rhetorically, Zionism has understood the power of the right of return, not only in its legal and ethical dimensions, but also in its ability to undermine the meaning that Zionists attributed to that very same concept. After all, it was Zionism which insisted that European Jewish descendants of European converts to Judaism were in fact descendants of the ancient Hebrews who had been allegedly expelled from ancient Palestine and whose repatriation and return was a moral and political imperative 2,000 years later. Note that Zionism's argument is not a historical one, wherein it was and is not claiming that the alleged Hebrew exiles of the first century should have had the right to return to Palestine then, but rather that their fictional descendants should have the right to do so 2 millennia later. These ideological premises would be enshrined in Israel's very own law of return, passed by the Knesset in July 1950. Yet it is the same Zionists who insist that the return of the Palestinian refugees, whether immediately following the expulsion in 1949 or every year since, is impractical and impossible. Today they express shock that refugees should have a right to return to their homeland a mere 65 years after their expulsion, while they insist on the rights of Jews to return after 2,000 years. In an attack on this very conference, one Richard Kravatz, a Boston-based Zionist propagandist, expressed his horror in the Time of Israel last week. Echoing standard Zionist arguments, he stated that, quote, "no population of refugees has ever presumed that the right of return, if such a right even exists, could be claimed not only by the original refugees, but also by their descendants," unquote. Kravat seems to have forgotten that it is European Jews whom Zionism had invented as fictional descendants of the fictional Hebrew refugees of the first century who have presumed exactly that very right in the name of which they colonized and colonized Palestine. While for Zionism, Jewish return is the very condition of colonization, Israel understands very well that the return of the actual Palestinian refugees and their descendants means nothing short of decolonization and the undoing of the Zionist project. Israel is, of course, correct in its assessment. It should be noted here that international law's understanding of the rights of the refugees includes the rights of their descendants to return. In addition to the annual UN reassertion of the Palestinian refugees' right of return, the right of return was upheld in principle and practice after the Bosnian War. Upwards of 500,000 refugees and internally displaced persons returned to their homes in Bosnia, a country of 3.5 million people, to places which were dominated demographically and politically by members of another ethno-national community, and they did so with international assistance following the 1995 Dayton Agreement. As the Bosnian case clearly demonstrates, the right of return of the refugees trumped the racially separatist policies of the local authorities who sought to continue to control the land of the displaced refugees and to populate it demographically with their own ethnic group at the expense of the refugees. International enforcement of the Bosnian refugees' right of return was based on the well-established right of return of refugees in international law and UN resolutions, while demographic racial separatism has no moral or legal standing in enforcing the refugees' rights. The problem for Zionism in Israel, however, is not the right of return, as that is central to their ideology and their colonial settler project, but rather with who is allowed to be a right of return-bearing subject in general. Like everything else with Zionism and Israel, their conception of rights is never universal, but always particular, indeed, always Jews-specific. Whereas for Zionism, Jews by definition are right of return-bearing subjects whose exercise of the right of return translates immediately into the colonization of Palestine, Palestinians can never be permitted to become right of return-bearing subjects, as their exercise of such a right translates immediately into decolonization. It is this particularism that informs the Israeli commitment to Jewish colonization, racial separatism, and supremacy, which Barack Obama supports unequivocally, and which stands in the way of Palestinian return. But unlike the Palestinians, who have the right to return to their homes according to international law and UN resolutions, which apply their criteria universally, not being refugees from Palestine, Jews are not granted the right to return to Palestine or Israel in any international convention or UN resolution. Indeed, it is Israel alone that has granted them that right on its own. All the international foundational documents of Zionism not only insist on the rights of the Palestinians and the rights of diaspora Jews to remain safe in the diaspora, but ironically, they grant no right of return to Jews. The British Balfour Declaration of November 1917 grants British support for the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, but it does so on the condition, and I quote, that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country, unquote. The League of Nations mandate for Palestine, which actually the Zionists helped script, reiterated the very same language, mentioning only the rights of non-Jews. The UN partition plan itself guarded in explicit terms against any expulsion of the population of the Jewish or the Arab states that it proposed. Once the expulsion was underway, the UN General Assembly issued its Resolution 194 on 11th December 1948, granting the Palestinian refugees the right of return and compensation for lost or damaged property. There is not one UN resolution, not one international legal document that grants Jews the right of return to Palestine or Israel. Whereas the Palestinians are considered right of return-bearing subjects in a universalist international law language, Jews have acquired that right only in the particularist Israeli law. This discrepancy is a central one to Israel's rejection of the Palestinian right of return. The arguments that Israel regularly puts forward have no international legal standing at all, but they do have standing within the structure of Zionist ideology. While the Israeli grant of Jewish right of return guarantees Jewish colonization and safeguards Jewish racial and religious supremacy, just as the expulsion of the Palestinians guarantees Jewish demographic supremacy, the Palestinian right of return, if implemented, would undermine both. Israeli leaders are clear on this, and they do not mince words when addressing this problem. Benjamin Netanyahu is only the latest Israeli leader to reiterate them. Namely, and I quote him, that the return of the Palestinians will wipe out Israel's future as a Jewish state, unquote. To guarantee his continuation in good standing as part of the Oslo process with his American and Israeli partners, Yasser Arafat conceded the Palestinian right of return in a New York Times editorial in 2002. Arafat frankly expressed his so-called understanding and respect of the Israeli need to maintain Jewish demographic supremacy. He asserted, and I quote him, "We understand Israel's demographic concerns and understand that the right of return of Palestinian refugees, a right guaranteed under international law and UN Resolution 194, must be implemented in a way that takes into account such concerns," unquote. Arafat proceeded to state that he was looking to negotiate with Israel on, quote, creative solutions to the plight of the refugees while respecting Israel's demographic concerns, unquote, i.e. respecting its Jewish supremacist demographic concerns. However, what makes the right of return of Palestinian refugees, whom Israel expelled and whose land it stole and steals, uncreative is not some geographic or demographic consideration, not some environmental or logistical obstacle. What makes their return not pragmatic is that they are not Jews, and therefore not right of return bearing subjects. Arafat's position was recently reiterated by his American picked successor, Mahmoud Abbas, who conceded his own right to return to the city of Safed, now in Israel, from which he and his family had been expelled in 1948. 10 years after Arafat's concession, Abbas declared on Israeli television in November 2012, and I quote him, "Palestine now for me is 67 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital. This is now and forever. This is Palestine for me. I am a refugee, but I am living in Ramallah. I believe that the West Bank and Gaza is Palestine, and the other parts are Israel," unquote. The reaction of the Palestinian refugees in the West Bank, in Gaza, in the diaspora, was swift, and their anger uncontainable. Abbas was burned in effigy and denounced across the Palestinian political spectrum. Palestinians understood that his renunciation of the right of return was an endorsement of Israeli colonialism and a Palestinian ratification of the Jewish settler colony. So did Israeli leaders. Israel's President Shimon Peres described Abbas's statement, and I quote, as a brave and important public declaration. And that Abbas, quote, understood that the solution to the Palestinian refugee issue cannot be in Israel's territory and to the detriment of Israel's character, unquote. Whereas Abbas's vision of the future of Palestine is shared by Israeli Jewish leaders and most Israeli Jews, unsurprisingly, it is not shared by most Palestinian refugees, as evidenced by the hostile popular reaction to his statements. Abbas's, however, is not the only Palestinian vision for the future. Another vision continues to animate Palestinian hopes and strategies for a restoration of their rights and for returning them to their homes. The Palestinian novelist Ghassan Kanafani articulated this vision more than four decades ago in his important 1969 novel, Returning to Haifa. Kanafani, in that novel, explored the return of expelled Palestinians to their homes. The novel depicts a Palestinian couple, Saeed and Safiya, refugees from Haifa who were expelled to the West Bank, driving back to their home in Haifa in June 1967. A return made possible by Israel's invasion and occupation of the West Bank a few weeks earlier. In the frenzy of the 1948 expulsion, the Palestinian couple's firstborn son, Khaldun, which means the immortal one, was left behind. Dreaming for 19 years of returning to their home in Haifa and of recovering their lost child, the Palestinians arrive at their home, now occupied by a European Jewish family, and their Palestinian son. Khaldun, it turned out, had been abducted and adopted, taken over by Zionism, just as the family home had been, just as the entire country had been. Renamed Dov, Bear, predatory bear, perhaps, their son was now serving in the Israeli army. The Palestinian couple's second son, Khalid, also a variation on Khaldun, meaning the immortal one, was born in the West Bank, wanted to join the Palestinian guerrillas, but his parents had opposed his decision before returning to Haifa. Yet their return to their still colonized homeland forced them to pose the question, what is a homeland? Saeed's answer to Safiya resists their erstwhile reactionary nostalgia that sought to return to Haifa, or to a Haifa that once was, and insists not on a pre-colonial past, but on a decolonized future. Let me quote what he says. I am looking for the real Palestine, the Palestine that is more than a memory, more than a son. As for us, you and I, Safiya, Palestine was something we searched for under the dust of memory. And look what we found under the dust, yet more dust. We made a mistake when we thought the homeland was only the past. For Khalid, their son in the West Bank, the homeland is the future. This is why Khalid wants to carry arms. There are tens of thousands like Khalid who are not halted by the tears men shed while looking in the depth of their defeats for scraps of their shields and broken flowers, but look forward to the future. And in doing so, they correct our mistakes. Indeed, the mistakes of the entire world. Dov is our shame, but Khalid is our enduring honor. Did I not tell you from the beginning that we should not have come back, and that our return requires that a war be waged? Let's go. Unquote. The war continues to be waged, but it is not a war of arms. There is an ongoing Palestinian legal and political struggle that aims to achieve a decolonized future for Palestinians and Jews. It is the war of boycott, or more precisely, the war of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. BDS understands well that colonization and expulsion are one and the same process, and that the reversal of one is the reversal of the other. The nonviolent war launched a decade ago by the Palestinian BDS movement and its international allies demands an end to Zionist colonization and the reversal of it through the dismantlement of the settler colonial racial structure that governs Israel and prevents the return of the Palestinian refugees. Hence the insistence by the BDS movement that overturning the racial legal privileges of Israeli Jews and turning Palestinians and Jews into equal citizens is the only program for decolonization and the only condition of and for the return of the Palestinian refugees. Thank you for staying.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment that is part of Truth and Justice Radio here on WZBC Newton 90.3 FM, airing from 6 a.m. till 10 a.m. We hope you join us again next week for news and views from and about Palestine.